Gut. The word Daita refers to one who has received the mercy of the Lord. Lord Jagannath has a number of stalwart servants known as Daitas. These servants do not come from very high caste families, Brahmanas, Kshatriyas or Vaishyas. But because they are engaged in the service of the Lord, they have been elevated to a respected position. Thus they are known as Daitas. These servants of Lord Jagannath take care of the Lord from the day of the Snan Yatra up to the time the Lord is carried from the throne to the Rathka. In the Kshetra Mahatmya, these Daitas are said to come from the Shabaras, a caste that keeps and sells pigs. However, among the Daitas, there are also many who come from the Brahmana caste. Those Daitas coming from the Brahmana families are called Daitapatis, or leaders of the Daitas. The Daitapatis offer food such as sweetmeats to Lord Jagannath during the Anusrara, the resting period after Snan Yatra. They also make the early morning offerings of sweetmeats daily. It is said that during the Anusrara, Lord Jagannath suffers from fever and that the Daitapatis offer him an infusion of drugs represented by fruit juice. It is said that in the beginning Lord Jagannath was worshipped by the Shabaras and was known as the deity Nilamadava. Later, when the deity was established in the temple, the Lord became known as Jagannath. Because the deities were taken from the Shabaras, all the Shabara devotees were elevated to the position of Daitas. Om Gyana Timirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadam Maiham Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeyaham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Twam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhan Vitamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dinabandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpa Trubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Vyavacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pushtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Nityanamine Namaste Sarasate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschita Deshatarine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Srivasadi Gauravakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare. Hare Krishna. I will try and speak a little bit, mainly about two points that came to me from this verse and this purport. One refers to the actual story that Srila Prabhupada is describing here, and he refers to the Kshetra Mahatmya, which is the, I believe he's referring here to the Sri Purushottam Kshetra Mahatmya in the Skanda Puran. So I just tried to look up that, and it was like 50 chapters, so I'm not going to try and summarize that. But there were some nice, interesting details in there, which I thought would be nice to go through. So I'll speak a little bit about that. And I'll also speak a bit about this idea, which is sometimes a little bit confusing, at least to my mind, where it refers to castes. And here, Srila Prabhupada is speaking about the Shabaras who are essentially keeping and selling pigs, and they were the worshippers of Jagannath, and how does that all kind of fit together? And there's a whole kind of narrative here about castes and Varnashram and what that means. So these two aspects I'll try and speak a bit about, if that's okay. We'll see how we do on time. So we'll start with the story. as I said, I'm going to try and just give you some snippets of it. The story, of course, that we know, when we visited Mayapur and Jagannath Puri, we hear the story of how Jagannath came to be and the story of King Indrajumna, So I'll try and speak about the bits which seem to add some more detail or diverge from kind of the narrative, because they're speaking from it from a different perspective. So the Skanda Purana speaks about the sage Jaimini reciting this story to a group of brahmanas who are asking questions, and he's essentially responding to this. And it begins by setting the whole scene in Satyuga. So this story is set there when King Indradyumna, who is the king of a town, the ancient city of learning called Avanti, had to bring that out. But he's the king of Avanti, and he's portrayed as this amazing personality, like this personality who has the kind of paralleled piety and power and opulence and all of these wonderful attributes that he has. And a very ideal king, and he's performed 1,000 Rajasuya Yagyas and all this type of Ashwamedha Yagya, sorry. So he, one day, he, as the pujaris in his city are doing the puja, he asks the priest that, where in this world can I see the Lord with these material eyes? Where is it possible to see the Lord with these material eyes? And so the priest goes out in front of the congregation who's gathered for the worship, and he proclaims this, that the king has requested this. And at that time, one pilgrim comes forward, and we don't know the identity of this personality, but he comes forward and he says that in Orissa there is a Nilgiri mountain where there is a banyan tree in the center, and to the west is a pond filled with primordial waters. By means of its mere contact, it bestows salvation. On its western bank is the body of Sri Vasudev made out of sapphires. And then he describes that around this place there's a hermitage, and there is this place called the Shabara Dipika. And interestingly, the word Shabara is used there, Srila Prabhupada is referring to in the purport here, that there is a kind of a hermitage of these persons who are Shabaras. And then he said, I spent 1 year there in this place called Sri Purushottam. And I observed many wonderful things. So he says this, and then he disappears. So everybody's left with this, you know, proclamation. And then the king decides, okay, like this is divine intervention. And he sees it as like that. And they set about trying to, because in the other story that we often hear, there was a dream. King Indradyumna Maharaj had a dream, and then he sent out his different search parties everywhere, and we hear about Vidyapati going and etc. So that comes a little bit, that comes now. So basically in Skanda Purana it's described that Vidyapati is actually the brother of the priest that King Indradyumna requested. So the priest says, my younger brother, he will go out and find out this for you, and he'll make all the arrangements so that you can, before you go visit, he'll go find the place, make all the arrangements, come back, and then take us and show us the way. So, so everybody starts preparing, and Vidyapati is very excited, of course, and he's anticipating his journey to Sri Purushottam, and he's anticipating seeing the Lord. And it's very beautifully described, actually. If you get a chance, please look it up. It's described how when he's going towards Sri Purushottam Kshetra, his meditation, it really reminds you of the meditation of Akura going to Vrindavan. Very, very kind of strong parallels, like his deep meditation of glorification of the Lord. And it's even described in the same way that he travels there and he doesn't even realize, like, you know, like in the same way it's described about Akura. He doesn't even realize how the time has gone, and he's past like Bhuvaneshwar, as we know, the town of Bhuvaneshwar where we have a wonderful temple, and then goes on to goes on further from that. And then it's described that when he's past Bhuvaneshwar, and then he keeps going, and he enters a space, and he's a little bit confused, because he sees these personalities with four arms, and they're holding all these the kind of symbols of Narayan. So he's like thinking, where have I come, and what kind, you know, have I taken rebirth, or where have I arrived? So he understands, like, clearly, you know, he's coming very close. So he climbs high up onto the mountain, and he tries to find the path that will lead him there, but he can't see the path. So he's somewhat confused, and he's tired, of course, from the journey. And so he lays down to take rest, but then he hears these amazing divine voices. and he starts to follow the voices. And as he follows the voices, he comes to this opening, and in that opening, he sees the houses that were described by the pilgrims, this hermitage of the Shabaras. And these are essentially personality. Shabaras are kind of, as Srila Prabhupada is explaining here, a mix of different castes, and they include like hunters, people who are keeping domesticated animals, etc. But also those of the Brahmana class who are also part of this group. So he comes forward, he enters, he knows that he's entering a very sacred place, so he's coming with great humility, and he sees these personalities. So as he proceeds at that time, a devotee, an older Shabara called Vishravasu. So you remember the name Vishravasu from the other story. So same personality, so he's coming forward. In the previous, in the alternative story, it's described how Vidyapati goes. And remember, he marries the daughter of Vishravasu because he's trying to get close to Vishravasu so that he can bring the king there. So he marries the daughter and he spends a long time. So it's not described in exactly the same way. So whether it's because of a different kalpa or something, I don't know. But here it's described that Vishravasu had just completed the worship of of Nilamadava. So he comes forward and out of this clearing, and he sees Vidyapati, and Vishravasu is holding these amazing remnants from the worship. So he realizes that this is what's happened, that he's come from worshipping, because he's holding all of these articles of worship. And he questions who Vidyapati is. And remember, this is a very secret place, so nobody really knows about this place. So he's surprised that who's this new person. So he goes to him and he asks him usual questions of welcome. And then he remembers. So Vishravasu is... knows of this foretelling, this legend, this idea that when this place ceases to become a secret, when it becomes known to the world, at that time, Nilamadava will disappear. And a king will come and he will establish a deity made out of wood. So Vishravasu is very scared. Like, he's like, now, so he's in this dilemma. He's like, do I tell him? Do I not tell him? But then he concludes that this foretelling was you know, it's divine arrangement, it's providence, and to try and fight against that is not going to do anybody any good. And this person is a sincere person. He's coming. He wants to take, you know, he wants to see the deity. So it's my duty to show him the deity. So so even though he has this apprehension, he takes Vidyapati and he takes him through this forested area on this path, which is described as very difficult. It's very rocky and rugged, you know, full of thorns, but they proceed and it's very dark. So he actually has to instruct Vidyapati just by speaking, because he couldn't see much. So he had to direct him like this and kind of single file up this difficult path up the mountain. And it takes about 90 minutes, is described. So the two murtas come together. And as they come through this space, then he sees this beautiful kalpa riksha tree, and on the side he sees a pond and a pathway in between. So Vishravasu, you know, tells him that we're now at the threshold. So he takes his bath in the pond and he proceeds forward. Now, here I'm just going to read a few things, because as Vidyapati proceeds forward, it's described that under this beautiful fig tree, the fig tree is a very auspicious tree in Vedic culture, and is the Lord holding the discus and club, and this Lord is made of blue sapphire gems. So I'll describe it here, because I won't be able to complete all of it because it's quite long, but you can read the description of how Vidyapati describes Nilamadava. And this section comes when he goes back, but I'll read it now. So this is the description of this Lord, of this deity. So he's 81 angulas, which is about 2 meters high, and he stands on a golden lotus. He has a beaming face, eyes like petals of a full-blown blue lotus. He bestows immortality and salvation. His forehead surpasses the beauty of the crescent moon of the eighth lunar day. His eyes censure the splendor of a pair of smiling blue lotuses. He dispels the three types of ever-increasing distresses by means of the nectar-rayed moon of his face. He appears very splendid with his nostrils, which are like a shining flower of sesame plant. The chin, it says, anyway, his chin, along with the jawbone, appears exceedingly charming on account of the cheeks beaming with laughter. Dimples are formed in his cheeks due to laughter. On either of his ears, there is an earring shaped like a makara. His neck increases the beauty of his neck ornament, gives the suspicion that the conch with right-handed curls has given birth to pearls. His shoulders are thick and large. He has four long arms stretching as far as the knees. The chest of the Lord sparkles with white spotless necklaces, and there he holds the 14 worlds reflected in the Kaushtubha gem. And now you can see for yourselves. Shri Radha Gokula Nanda Ki Jai. He is adorned with necklaces, bracelets, armlets, crown, etc. And he illuminates all the cardinal points. Thus he is installed on the Nila mountain. So then he goes on to describe that Lakshmi Devi, who occupies his left side, is embraced by the Lord, holding a lotus in his hand. She is engaged in playing on the lute with her eyes fixed on the face of the Lord. She is the abode of all beauty and is adorned with all ornaments. Sudarshan stands in front, and behind him, Garuda with palms joined. Okay, so now he has this amazing darshan. He's obviously in total ecstasy. And Vishwavasu requests him now to return back to take rest and to have prasad. And as Vidyapati comes, then he sees that the feast that's laid out by Vishwavasu is like a feast for the demigods. And he's thinking, like, these guys are, you know, like, they're staying in this simple forest. How is it that they've got this incredible... So he asks. So Vishwavasu is a bit reluctant. How much should I tell this personality? But then he describes. So he says that actually every day, all of the devatas led by Brahma, Lord Shiva and Indra, they come and they make all of these offerings to the Lord. They hear their offering and whatever articles of worship, like the scent, the, you know, flowers, all of these things which are divine. So they last forever. And so they never fade. They never fade in flavor or scent or look. And they provide or they bestow immortal life. And that's why all of us are just so happy here. Like we're just constantly taking the remnants of Nilamadava, and he's sustaining us like that. So he hears all of this, he actually requests Vidyapati. He says that, look, there is a foretelling. This is going to happen. There's a foretelling that this secret becomes known, Nilamadava is going to disappear. So please don't tell the king. So he's trying, but he knows in his heart he's going to have to tell him. But you know, out of his own obviously attachment to this deity, he's requesting. So Vidyapati returns, and the king can see, and everybody, the whole city can see, like something has happened to this personality. He's just in complete ecstasy, and he's holding this garland that he's brought from the deity, and this garland is still ever fresh. And he places this garland on King Indradyumna. Indradyumna actually bows down to Vidyapati because he can just feel his spiritual potency. So he touches his head to the floor, and then King Indradyumna obviously is just like just so anxious to hear. So Vidyapati says, he gives a description that I've already read, and then he said, "I saw those two, the parents of the universe, stationed on the mountain. They are silent. With their eyes smiling, they bless all those who view them. As they bless all living beings, I thought them to be alive. Shesha, with his many hoods, forming an umbrella, is stationed behind them. Having seen directly that the Lord of Shri, of wonderful form and features like this, my mind runs back to that place as though dragged with ropes." Because when he has that darshan, actually he doesn't want to come back to King Anuja. Of course, he just wants to stay there, but duty calls him back. So I'm going to pause the story there just because, as I said, it's a very long and beautiful narration. And if you get a chance, please look it up. It's a wonderful description. And so, if that's okay, we will now just speak a little bit about. So it's 8. What time does class go to? 8:30. Oh, 9 is Saturday. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. So we have a little bit of time. Okay. So we'll shift then our conversation to the purport references to the Shabras and the caste system, and this idea of, because, you know, remember, this story is set in Satyuga, right? We said it was set in Satyuga, and yet you have kings, you have brahmanas, you have these Shabras, you have these different individuals playing different roles. And we know from 11th canto, when Krishna is explaining the Varnashram system to Uddhava, in that chapter, when Krishna describes how the Varnashram system came about, he says that in the Satyuga, there was only one Varna, remember? And that one Varna was called Hamsa. I don't know if that rings any bells, but he says Hamsa as that one Varna, which, because everybody is naturally, from birth, he says, devotees of Krishna. And as we proceed through the different yugas, then the Varnashram system becomes in varied ways influenced by the modes of material nature. And Varna, kind of from a philosophical perspective, Varna is based on guna, right? Krishna says guna and karma, yeah? So we have in the Satyuga a situation where people are performing different types of karma, though it's not karma, it's devotion, because they're all devotion inclined, but they're performing different types of work, but their guna, Krishna says, is of a hamsa, like a devotee, as opposed to influenced so much by passion and ignorance. So as we proceed through the yugas, the Varnashram system becomes increasingly differentiated, rigid, and finally corrupted. Right? So like we see that corruption happening, and as we know, Srila Prabhupada's Guru Maharaj, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, spent much of his time defeating two corrupt ideas. One was the idea of Mayavad, that Krishna has no eternal spiritual form, and the other one was caste is based on birth, right? That our right to devotion, or our adhikar, qualification, thank you. Our qualification to perform devotional services determined by birth. Yeah, so these two ideas were very firmly refuted by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And I remember when I, many, many years ago, when I first read that book, Brahmana and Vaishnava, I was wondering, like, why is there so much emphasis? Like, why did Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who is such, like, who had, you know, like, who could be preaching and speaking about so many things, why did he focus so much on birth as a qualification? Because, like, who cares about that anyway? Like, in a Western perspective, we don't have that as such a conscious thing, but in India, it's such a big thing. And the thing is that just like Varnashram, so when we speak about Varnashram, we're talking about archetypes. These are eternal archetypes, because this is Krishna's system. Like, there are these eternal archetypes of different roles, the Varnas, and different stages in life, the Ashramas. And the Ashramas correspond incredibly perfectly, scientifically, to the psychological changes that we go through in our life. So the austerities and the rewards that are there for each of those ashramas correspond to what we need as human beings to flourish in our life through the different stages, to evolve us closer and closer and closer to Krishna. And that's for the general populace. Of course, Varnashram works on a system level. It's not based on individual exceptions, which there will always be. So there's always individual kind of flexibility and exceptions. Like, for example, if somebody skips that and goes straight from Naishtik Brahmacharya to sannyas, like that's an idea of an exception. So We have one example. So these ideas are there as built into the system of how the cosmos works. So that's why Varnashram is actually such an important idea. And as Srila Prabhupada said, 50% of my work is done. My Guru Maharaj told me this story because it was he was looking after Srila Prabhupada in his last few months. And he said that Srila Prabhupada woke up in the middle of the night and he was like lamenting that he couldn't do enough. And my Guru Maharaj says that he, obviously my Guru Maharaj's response is like retelling like how everything Srila Prabhupada has done and how can you say you haven't done enough, you've saved the world. And it went on to speak like that about Srila Prabhupada. And Srila Prabhupada said that, but 50% is not done, and that 50% is Varnashram. And when my Guru Maharaj reflected on that and he was speaking about how important that is, he was thinking like, Srila Prabhupada did so much we can't comprehend. Now if that's 50%, the other 50% has to be like, how great does it have to be? And part of the challenge here is that when we think about Krishna consciousness and including, a house in which the whole world can live, this idea that of including everybody within Krishna consciousness, somehow connected to Krishna consciousness, that requires Varnashram. Because not everybody will be able to directly connect with pure devotional service from the beginning. And therefore the idea is, how does everybody find a place in somehow we connect them to Krishna's bigger plan. And we see that again and again. We even see it in the Gita, like when Krishna's saying, if you think of me all the time. If you can't do that, perform regulate devotion. You can't do that, again, all the way down to, if you can't do any of these things, at least just do something good. Do something pious, right? Like that's where he ends up. And same thing with the yoga ladder. We have all these different levels in the yoga ladder. Why? Because we want everybody, whoever they are, wherever they're coming from, somehow get connected. Because if you get connected, then it's only then a matter of time. As long as you don't become offensive, it's only a matter of time. You'll keep moving forward. You have the right knowledge, which is why we give Srila Prabhupada's books. So they have the seed. They have everything they need in Srila Prabhupada's books, regardless of their background or knowledge base, they have everything they need to attain pure devotional service. Then it's just a matter of how quickly they want to proceed on that journey. But somehow or another, we try and connect them. And here, this idea of no bar to being, like, I think it's so amazing, like how it's described like this, where this class of Shabaras are given the responsibility of this amazing deity, and they're looking after it. And normally you think only the highest class brahmanas would be able to, do all of these types of things, etc. And here the Shabaras are doing it. And this tells us something. It tells us about the essence of Krishna consciousness being beyond all these designations and boundaries and limitations of what is otherwise a very constrained and corrupted system based on birth. And I'll read you these two texts, which you'll know, which one is from the third canto, chapter 33, verse 7, which is a verse that actually Devahuti speaks. And it begins, Aho Bhattaswa Pascho Togarean. So, oh, how glorious are they whose tongues are chanting your holy name. Even if born in the families of dog eaters, such persons are worshipable. Persons who chant the holy name of your lordship must have executed all kinds of austerities and fire sacrifices and achieved all the good manners of the Aryans. To be chanting the holy name of your lordship, they must have bathed at holy places of pilgrimage, studied the Vedas, and fulfilled everything required. This idea that all of these other things, all of these things about, the Vedic system is you take birth in a particular varna, you do piety, you do your regulated activities for that varna and ashram, and then in your next life, you go to the next varna, and then the next one, and then the next one. Over lifetimes, many, many lifetimes, potentially. You proceed through the different stages of the Varnashram system, and finally you attain to goodness, the Brahminical platform. Then you take to devotional service. If you're lucky, you come across somebody, and then you achieve transcendence, right? So that's the long version. And the long version works if you have a perfect society that allows that progression year on, lifetime after lifetime. If you don't have that society, if you don't have that infrastructure, then Srila Prabhupada has to come and he has to give us pure devotional service condensed in his books and say, here you go, skip the whole thing and just proceed, right? Attain and accelerate your process through the modes, through ignorance, through passion, through goodness, to transcendence just by performing devotional service and chanting the holy names. So all of these other things, sometimes they are seen as great qualifications. You know, these things like studying the Vedas, visiting place of pilgrimage, bathing in holy places, fire sacrifices. All of these things are seen as great qualifications. And they're seen sometimes confused, even now, like we see, and this is the point about why Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati was so strong, is that as the Varnas are archetypes, Mayavad philosophy and this contamination of the Varnashram system based on birthright is also a constant threat. It's not like it goes away. It will keep coming back because it's part of human psychology. Like the part of human psychology based on false ego, which makes us think, I am God. Krishna doesn't have an eternal form. That same kind of deviant mentality also seeps into the potential when we learn a bit of Sanskrit or when we learn a bit of like ritual, that we can we may have the tendency to think that we are doing something which is higher or better or greater than the holy name. And that's a dangerous mentality. And it gets even worse when you're born in a situation where you have all of these things like around you, and you have all of the culture and all of these learnings. That becomes even more of a threat. Most of us born in the West, I mean, I was born in India, but I came here when I was a year old. So like, you know, like most of us grown up in the West, like it will take a lot for us to get that egotistical because we know our background. But for those people born in those situations, they can get quite carried away quite quickly. So then there's another verse, and this is, I love this verse. So this is 8th canto, chapter 23, verse 16. Now, this is mantratas tatratas chidram, right? So there may be discrepancies in pronouncing the mantras and observing the regulative principles. There may be discrepancies in doing these things. And moreover, there may be discrepancies in regard to time, place, and person, and paraphernalia. But when your lordship's holy name is chanted, everything becomes faultless. Now, the best thing about this verse is who spoke it. Eliwad Ravama, who spoke it? I heard it just now. Shukracharya. This verse comes at the, you know, the whole story of Bali Maharaj. So then, at that time, Vamana Dev says to Shukracharya, so tell us, what did Bali Maharaj do wrong? Tell us, what were the faults, the discrepancies in the yaga? Now, Shukracharya is the spiritual master of the asuras, right? So like the daityas, he's the Brihaspati equivalent for them. And he knows his stuff. He's like the perfect brahmana in the smarter brahmana, ritualistic brahmana sense. He is the perfect brahmana. Like, he knows everything. He can tell you the mantra to bring dead bodies alive. So he knows every slight discrepancy. So it's amazing that after this process, he comes to this realization. What was I talking about? These things are just like so superficial. And he makes this statement that there may be so many discrepancies, all these other types of things, but when your holy name is chanted, at that time, everything becomes faultless. And so we're hearing it from the right person. Like, why is it like Vamanadeva is making him say that, right? Because if he says it, then it must be true, because he's the personification of that opposing argument. Like, he's what we would call nowadays steel manning the argument. Like, you know, he's by the person who's saying it. And so it's just, I think, a wonderful way in which Srila Prabhupada gives us these two things, and I'll just bring it back now before we pause for any comments, is that Srila Prabhupada kind of gives us these two things in parallel and in such a way that is so perfectly suited for our time, place, and circumstance. One is this vision, this idea of this personal relationship based in ecstatic devotional service with Krishna, where we hear these stories and these descriptions of Krishna, and in a way that evokes our emotion and emotional attachment to Krishna. That's going on, and that, remember, is the climax. It is the many, many thousands and millions of births in the traditional system we would have to take to get to that situation. Srila Prabhupada is giving it to us in Krishna book. Like, that's, you know, the fast track version. And at the same time, he's giving us an insight into how the Varnashram system, which is a necessary tool for us in our sharing of Krishna consciousness with the whole world, how that can be implemented and its importance in that regard, but informed by Krishna consciousness as opposed to ritual or other things that can potentially contaminate it as we proceed into Kali Yuga, when this becomes increasingly prominent. So in so many different ways, Srila Prabhupada is giving us the perfect formula, as we know, but it comes out in every purport that he provides us. So I'll pause there, if that's okay. If there are any comments or clarifications, yes, Prabhu.
Thank you for the class. My question is about in Satya Yuga, you mentioned about the Hamsas, and I was a bit confused because trying to understand that. From what I know, Lord Narasimhadev appeared in Satya Yuga and this into the demonic society. You know that there was, and there seems to be divisions there in terms of brahmanas, and just trying to understand how it would work.
Yeah, no, thank you. That's an important clarification. So we have these stories from Satya Yuga, many, many stories, where it is described that what seems to be Varnashram seems to be in place because we have these different roles. So there's two points. One is that the roles that were being performed were not based on birth. They were not rigid, and they were based in devotion. So that's why Krishna is calling them Hamsa. So that's in terms of the roles, the distinction between roles that exists even in Satyuga. That's one thing. Then the second point is that why were there these daityas and different types of person? And that's because in the story and the chronology of how these different personalities come about, remember, these personalities are outside of the Varnashram system. So like an Asura, for example, is not a Shudra. Is not a Shudra. Because if you read the descriptions of what a Shudra is, like sometimes we have this tendency to think about a Shudra in a demeaning way. But if you read the description of how Krishna is describing the qualifications of a Shudra, it's actually a very, very faithful, dutiful position and important, extremely important role in society. And it's outside of that strict Varnashram kind of categorization where these other Yavanas, Mlechas, Daityas, etc. exist. So there's two things happening kind of simultaneously, which is why sometimes it can be, I had the same kind of question. Yeah, thank you. Yes, Prajan. Mike's coming. If somebody can just turn it on.
You can see in the animal system, all the living entities, they have a relationship going. You know, even the ants and the spiders. And they only live for a very short time. But actually, it's all about relationships. And they have male, female. But some are, they don't even have that. Mm. You know, you wonder what slugs are. You know, how does it happen? You know, how do they get created? Mm. But they're still living entities. They've got a super, their souls in them. And so we can see it when we look about it in nature. Each, whatever we see, this variegated system, you know, it must have a purpose. Mm. It must come from somewhere. Mm. It's logical. Mm. And that's how I see things. It appealed to my nature when I came to Krishna consciousness. how everything can be accepted in Krishna's service.
Okay. Thank you. And just if I can just add a little bit to that, reflect on that. Just the, you know, as I was saying about archetypes, and the reason why this Varnashram system is like that is because they are based on the gunas. So all of this distinction, as Krishna describes the upside down tree, right, the Ashwatha tree, like this idea, all of that distinction that occurs through the differentiation of how these three modes of material nature are interacting. That produces the variety. So all of these things, for sure, and human beings included. So we see that pervading the whole of creation. And Varna is just one way of it also coming out in a manifest way. And, you know, just yesterday I read this extract from a study that showed, so they had these ants, you're speaking about like this intelligence that exists there. They had this group of ants and they had a group of human beings. And they had a proportionate large size object that this group had to take through a maze. And you know, the ants did it better than the human beings. And it's like, how did these ants figure this out better than human beings? And like, they set some parameters, so it was like a level playing field. So like, you know, you couldn't speak and those types of things. But it was just incredible. Like, so there is, you know, Paramatma's there. You know, like Srila Prabhupada was saying, you know, every species has its intelligence in a way that we can't have. So like he gave the example that there's a grain of sugar and these, you won't be able to find it, but the ants are finding it, you know, like they have that intelligence. Yeah. Huh? Yeah. So yes, Marsh.
Thank you, Naveen Prabhu. Last class. Just on this point of going away from birth and guna and karma rather than janma, it seems like a general social phenomena is to go from like one extreme to the other. And then we kind of, we're in a society where we just kind of say like birth doesn't matter, you know, nothing, you shouldn't be restricted by that. And we kind of, so can you say something about how we can take the good side of looking at our birth and what, you know, comes with that? And how we can appropriately do that in our life and as a society to not ignore it, but not use it as a restriction as well.
Mm. Yeah, no, thank you. That's a very helpful. because you're right, there's a tendency to kind of go from one extreme to the other, and then we just keep... and actually, the Vedic like approach to everything pretty much is to hold it in balance, you know, like that. How do we reconcile these two things? And I guess the reason why we've seen historically our acharyas speaking very strongly against this idea of birthright is because there was such a tendency towards that direction, and we're just trying to bring it back to a center point. So the idea of, I think what's important is in when we're trying to reconcile these things, for us to be really, really clear as to what is the, like, what is the philosophical principle? So what is the transcendent philosophical principle? And once we know that, then other things need to tether to that. They need to fall in line with that to support that principle. So the principle here is not, can be mistaken for being based on birth. So if we establish the principle, transcendental devotional service, the holy name, you know, the things that we know are essential, the most important, they're the apex. They're the thing which the entire Vedic system is trying to take us towards. First, do we accept that? Do we accept that the holy name sits on top of that whole idea? If you accept that, and that's not clear always, like it's not always, not everybody accepts that, right? So if we accept that the holy name's at the top of that apex, then how did these other things, qualifications, birth, all, how did they then dovetail towards that? And as Srila Prabhupada said, we have all these zeros, add a one in front. So it's not to say that, you know, education, birth, opulence, these reputation, all of these things, they're not intrinsically. The idea is that they're not intrinsically useful for Krishna consciousness, or we reject them and we have no focus on them. The idea is that, yeah, we want to bring good, devotionally inclined children into this world. Birth matters from that perspective, because if you have a devotional environment, then it will increase the opportunity for that living entity to take up devotional service. So for sure, and if you're born, as Prabhupada said, if you're born into a family of doctors, you have the opportunity to become a doctor. So Srila Prabhupada gave us the framework for that, that birth gives all of these things, you give you an opportunity. If I have, you know, £10 in my pocket, I have the opportunity to give £10. If I don't have the £10, I have no opportunity to give. So if I have good birth, I have the opportunity to use that birth in Krishna service, like everything. So I think that for me is like the way that hopefully we can approach this in a balanced way, is first of all being crystal clear that devotional service, you know, for us, time, place, and circumstances, means the holy name, essentially, comes to the holy name at the top of that. And everything else, how does it fit in that pyramid to help us get to chanting attentively and then finally purely? And then if we keep that in frame, then everything's okay. I think then we can find a place for everything. But if we lose that, then it's kind of like everyone's doing their own thing and everyone has a different goal and everyone thinks that one service is better than another service, all of that stuff, you know, which, is that okay? Or is there some...
No, that's really useful. I just to bring it, I guess, to a very real point, like say, for example, we've got social group A, I won't say who it is or what it is, but, and they're born in a certain way. So you could go to one ISKCON community where it could be like, because of that birth, like, that's it. You're not, you know, you're restricted.
Yeah.
And you could go to ISKCON community B where it's like, oh yeah, forget it. It doesn't matter. Everyone can do everything here and we're not even going to look at that. So is there a golden mean between those two of what an ISKCON community would function like and look at someone's social group? And how, and what could that look like? Like,
you see, like, we have so many examples where people are stepping, even in our scripture, where people are stepping outside of their born social group, right? So like somebody's born in a Brahminical family, but they're a Kshatriya. So like we have that examples. So in our context, in the modern context, if somebody is saying that a social group X is precluded from worshipping the deities, as an example, so then the question is, okay, why? Like, based on what? So if you have some reason to do that, then as an intelligent society with Srila Prabhupada's books as our basis, then we have to be able to find that guidance, that principle in Srila Prabhupada's books. So did Srila Prabhupada do it? So in his example, is there scriptural reference for it? Is there precedence for it? If there is a scriptural reference, how does Srila Prabhupada interpret and implement that scriptural reference in today's... You know, like, there's so many ways in engaging in that. But I think sometimes what happens is we do something, we don't know why we're doing it. Like, on what basis, on what principle, on what... And it to be able to engage in that conversation, to be able to interrogate it and to have a constructive conversation without getting personal, without getting, like, you know, defensive and all of those types of things, we as a society have to mature into that. Like, because, right, it feels sometimes that I have a view, I want to, like, that's just my view, and if you like it, then good, otherwise off you go. Like, you know, we don't, whereas that's not our tradition. You know, if we speak about, like, all of this high philosophy, these stories, all of these things, like, They have to mean something in terms of like their application to our life, our society, our ways in which we, like in your example, make decisions about what goes on in our temples. So I would say in that situation, we should be able to have the conversation. If you want to make a principle, if I want to make a principle like this social group X, then I have to be able to explain why. And that has to be open to conversation. So, yeah. Yes, Gunpo. Sorry.
Hare Krishna, thank you. Just to carry on from Maharaj's question. So it is the case, when we do look at it from the ISKCON concept, it is very black and white, not by birth, not... Now, just to For me, that what muddies it is this. You mentioned the Brahmanism-Vaishnavism debate. So in that debate, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, he won the debate. On the opposing side is Bipin Bihari, who's the Diksha Guru of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And in Bhaktivinoda Thakur's bhajans, he's describing him as Vilas Manjari, and he's kind of worshipping him. And I don't see any evidence that Bhaktivinoda Thakur actually stopped worshipping Bipin Bihari. I mean, of course, he took Jagannath Das Babaji as his main kind of shiksha. So it seems that can we put Bipin Bihari in a box and say he's bogus or not? I don't want to do it because he's in the bhajans of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and how would Bhaktivinoda Thakur describe him as Vilas Manjari if he doesn't have his Manjari Swarup, you know? So maybe it is the case that, is it just spiritual variety? There's just two different opinions and we're in one particular camp, so we parrot that particular opinion, and the other one is bona fide, but we make out that it's not bona fide completely. Is it really that black and white, you see?
Yeah. No, that's a helpful question. So, you know, we have examples of, like, for example, when Jiva Goswami is exalting, the mood of the queens of married rasa with Krishna, sometimes even above the conjugal rasa that we understand normally in our tradition between the unmarried bhava. And he does that for a reason, as it's explained to us. And the reason is because to prevent people going down an immoral route. And so he's establishing the principle there. Now, of course, we know Jiva Goswami's internal idea and mood because he is who he is and he's the follower of Rupa Goswami. So there are times, I don't know enough about Vipin Bihari just in terms of his relationship and future and later relationship with Bhaktivinoda Thakur and all of that stuff. I don't know enough about that to comment. But I think just as a principle that we have to understand these things through those personalities whom we are following. You see, ultimately, it's a matter of faith. Where do I place my faith? So I came to Krishna consciousness, I came to ISKCON, my faith is in Srila Prabhupada. Like for me, that's where my faith is. Whatever he said, I found to be true. And so if he has an opinion about something that is beyond my understanding, beyond my reach, I can intellectualize it about it as much as I need to or want to. I can research into it as much as I want to. And that's all fine and good and perfectly okay. But ultimately, if my conclusion leads me to a thing into a position which is in contradiction to where Srila Prabhupada has kind of positioned himself, then I need to think about that further, right? I need to think of where does that stay for me, and in my mind, I think that's where this point comes, that Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur had whatever conversation relationship he had. I don't have insight into that. I know where Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur kind of ended up in terms of what was his position. So Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is the son of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He knows, is, you know, like we're talking about Rathi Yatra, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is praying to Lord Jagannath, right? Give me a son who will take my mission forward, who will carry the mood of what. So he's doing that. Bhaktisiddhanta comes out, the Rath cart stops in front of his house, the garland falls. I mean, there's enough signs that we need, that at least I need, that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is the, I can, you know what I mean? So, and then Srila Prabhupada is his disciple. So whatever line that they are taking, because ultimately there are so many different lines that you can follow. You can, even if you go now to Mayapur Vrindavan, you can get a philosophy for anything. So ultimately it's where do we want to place our faith? And then, and I think they were making this very strong point because there was this potential to move away from it. But I do take the principle, and I think that was what I was trying to say in response to Maharaj's point, that I agree, there's no sense in swimming from one extreme to another extreme. At end, you know, I often feel like truth doesn't generally lie in the extremes, right? It's somewhere, there is something that we need to find reconciliation for. And from my perspective, I think that Srila Prabhupada's reconciliation of that idea of birth or no birth being material is quite clear. Like, it's a perfect reconciliation as far as I can see. And the reconciliation is as simple as that, is that ultimately Krishna's goal, Krishna's framework is guna and karma, and birth has its role, but it's like any other material qualification. It's a material qualification. It's not a spiritual qualification. You have a material qualification. It helps you, can help you, if used properly in Krishna service, go ahead. And that's true for brahmanas, it's true for people born in the West, in kind of Western families, because they have a different type of material qualification that they can also use so much in Krishna service that can be greater than what somebody born in a brahmana family can do. They have a different a set of opulence. I don't mean that wealth-wise, I mean whatever opulence. Whether that's intelligence, ability to connect with different people, whatever it is. So I don't see the contradiction is what I'm saying. I think it's perfectly reconciled in the way Srila Prabhupada encouraged us to practice Krishna consciousness. Okay. So, you decide. Yes, please, for me.
Yeah, I just want to make a recommendation. I can't tell you what's in it because it's so beautiful. Uh-huh. But it's Sri Krishna Namastakam. It's a combination of Rupa Goswami and Raghunath Das Goswami, which describes the glories of the holy name. And that's all. But you can look it up on the internet, and it'll give you all the verses that lead to our relationship with each other in Krishna consciousness. Okay.
Thank you, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna, if you forgive me, I missed the start of the class of finishing rounds. You were saying the holy name is the top, but sometimes it's not seen like that. Could you clarify what you meant by that?
Just because sometimes it's seen and has the potential to creep in also into spiritual societies, including ours, that if we take our eye off the ball, you can hear or start to see arguments arise about how other things can be competitors to the holy name. It could be things like various types of rituals, it could be even pancharatric things, it could be other aspects, some of which are closer and closer in hierarchy to the holy name in terms of the nine aspects of devotional service, but some outside also. And within and outside of ISKCON, obviously outside of ISKCON you can see it a lot. Yeah, well, I wasn't making a complicated point there. yeah, you just missed the context, yeah. So Krishna Sakapuru?
Thank you, Prabhu, for your class. When you're speaking about Varnan Ashram, you're speaking about the austerities of the different Varnas and different ashrams. I wonder if you could, particularly on the point of ashram, what are the austerities for the different ashrams, and I guess what are the lessons you're meant to learn as you go through, if you have enough time?
I don't have enough time, but I can tell you where to look. So actually, there's two things. One is 11th canto, where Krishna is speaking to Uddhava about the Varnas ashram. So you'll get the principles there. You'll also get it just as you think about these archetypes, like what is it, you know, like the duties of a brahmachari. For example, in Grasa Ashram, we talk about charity as one idea, right? So that's an austerity you're supposed to perform. And we know the allowances in Grasa Ashram in terms of engagement with sense gratification in a way which is not allowed in the other three ashrams, right? So like that is a very basic idea, but you can see even with something like a kshatriya whose austerity is you have to be willing every day to put your life on the line. If duty calls, that's your job, right? So that's your austerity. You have to be willing to give up your life on the battlefield to protect other people. But the reward is you do have access to, some enjoyable things, right? You have opulence. You have these. So like that, each varna and ashram. And the other place that you can see, if you want to dive in a bit deeper, is Urmila Devi has written a book called Kriya Dharma. So Kriya Dharma, and in there, I haven't read all of it, but I have heard her seminars on the book, and in there she also goes in a bit deeper with regards to the rewards and austerities of each of the ashramas, so and varnas, of course. Is that okay? Just because we've got a minute left. Okay. I think we're at the end of time. Thank you all so much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.